You need quality sounds? Tune into CKUT 90.3 on the Frequency Modulation Band Radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT.
The Association des Services de Réhabilitation Sociale du Québec is filing a class action suit. If you were strip searched between July 13, 2006 and July 1, 2011, if you were in one of the following facilities, Bordeaux, Rivière-des-Prairies, Roberval, Saint-Jérôme, or the male sector of Quebec City, you may be able to be part of this claim. For complete details, go to asrsq.ca/class action. That's asrsq.ca/class action. Claims must be filed before January 16th, 2022.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM. Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised.
Was put on ice at the end of last year's legislative session, so it's up for a vote again this January, and Senator Scott Wiener tried to announce some amendments to the bill today, but you could hardly hear him over the crowd.
Today, we have new amendments to Senate Bill 50 based on feedback that we have received.
If you're looking for a microcosm of the housing affordability crisis, look no further than Oakland City Hall today.
I'm Mary Crisis.
I'll be Mary Interrupted.
I'm Mary Lack of Creativity.
And I am Mary Napkins. Hello, this is the Gay Shame Podcast. This is Gay Shame Podcast number 7. Gay Shame is a radical trans queer direct action group based in San Francisco that has been operating since 2001.
Gay Shame is a virus in the system. We are committed to a trans queer extravaganza that brings direct action to spectacular levels of confrontation. We work collectively outside boring and deceptive nonprofit models to fight white supremacy, capitalism, ableism, cops, settler colonialism, and all forms of domination. Liberals think that we are frivolous decorations and mainstream gays want us gone. Against them and with each other, we instigate, irritate, and agitate to build cultures of devastating resistance.
Now, we are going to talk about YIMBY and YIMBYs. What is a YIMBY? Who is a YIMBY? YIMBY has been Gay Shame's nemesis of late in many different ways, and we're going to break down and explain to you why it is. It's not just ours, it's everyone's, and everyone around the world, not just San Francisco, because a lot of the YIMBY activity is starting to, well, they've pretty much done nearly almost everything that they can do in this city and get away with. Not that they've stopped, but they are definitely spreading all across the globe into other cities. YIMBY is coming to your town. So how do you deal with YIMBYs? How do you identify them? How do you fight them? How do you stop them? How will we all survive together, and how will we steal the land back for each other so that we don't have to, you know, whatever. We will discuss that tonight.
Yes. And many of you may be asking, just give me a hint. What does YIMBY stand for? It stands for Yes in My Backyard, as in yes, build luxury condos in my backyard. They're basically a PR front for condo developers, libertarians who love Ronald Reagan and the free market and supply and demand trickle-down economics, which does not work. And their name comes from their pretend, totally fake opposition to NIMBYs, or the not-in-my-backyarders. NIMBYs are the stereotype of the cranky neighbors who block housing in their neighborhood, block any new development. But actually, as we will let you know throughout the episode, YIMBYs and NIMBYs are fighting on the same side. They're both just interested in money, getting those property values up for the real estate industry, and getting those rents up for the landlords.
So yes, when we're talking tonight, there's going to be a great deal. It's going to be very information dense tonight. So by all means, rewind the podcast, go over it several times. There will be a quiz later, but it's incredibly specific information just because unfortunately we have amassed way more information than any human being should ever have to be burdened with in this fight. And we're always incredibly eager to want to offload it on the nearest person or trauma bond or whatever, consensually or not consensually. But you have tuned into this tonight, so assumingly, I'm assuming that you want to hear us talk about YIMBYs.
No, it's not knowledge we lack.
Things never work out the way I planned. Yes.
And we will include lots of, you know, reading material, explainers for some of these terms, like below market rate, which is we could do several episodes on that. And then New York City, how they have the Poor Door.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually cut that.
No, I can, whatever, it's fine. Yeah. So yeah.
Nobody was killed at Stonewall.
One of the most insidious parts of YIMBYism is how they will use the language of social justice or housing justice, this veil of progressivism, in order to achieve what they want, which is to set up the world for more high-end real estate.
So YIMBYs claim that they are pro-housing. However, they are attempting to dictate the conversation on land and who gets to do what with it.
We read the bill! We read the bill!
The quality of our life will simply be destroyed if 827 is passed.
It's a narrative war that is being penned by the real estate industry, and their models are simple. It allows property developers and landlords to control where people can go and serves as like a legacy of colonization.
Living here. I want our healthcare workers to keep living here, our firefighters, our police officers, and they're having to leave the city because the city has done nothing while we are in an urgent housing crisis.
KPIX5's Wilson Walker explains this is only the beginning.
And just as Salesforce has been filling up over the last year, so has the rest of South of Market with a wave of high and mid-rise buildings from just off the Embarcadero all the way out to Van Ness. And not only are they filling in that new skyline, they are redrawing its sense of style.
It is, but it's beautiful. I mean, very seldom do you see architecture like this. So I'm happy to have it. And
it's not really a coincidence that the YIMBY model is adopted from Nordic housing models, like democracies that are like hailed for like their housing and their healthcare models. They're, you know, countries that like continue to be very racist, especially towards immigrants. And, you know, YIMBYs pride themselves on their knowledge around the housing crisis, the housing shortage, and the history of redlining, racial segregation, poverty, and houselessness.
Delighted to have with us this evening Richard Rothstein, who's written The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. We're very fortunate also to have with us this evening Ta-Nehisi, who's here to be in conversation with Richard.
When YIMBYs talk about the history of redlining, they're using it as an alibi to continue to move white people into black neighborhoods. They believe that you know, the civil rights legacy of the fight against redlining is to deregulate
zoning.
It's because of zoning.
The conditional zoning.
Racial zoning.
To upzone an area or to liberalize a community plan.
Deregulate zoning laws. And that's all they like zoning laws for further, you know, luxury condo development in black and brown neighborhoods.
California YIMBY is committed to advancing fair housing, but we need to acknowledge that we, like many YIMBYs, are new to this space. I believe it's past time that we YIMBYs, whatever our background, make common cause with fair housing advocates and fight to overturn exclusionary housing policies in the legislature and at the ballot box. To introduce Richard Rothstein.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Constantine. It's a pleasure to be here with you. YIMBY is one of my favorite organizations.
What other solutions do you think could begin to reverse this history of specific solutions you think could reverse this history of segregation and build some wealth?
Well, I think zoning reform that increases density is an essential first step. Let me just say, I'm very much in favor of increasing density. As you know, I was in favor of the two bills that the YIMBY promoted.
However, the whole concept of mass and mixed-use development serves as a disadvantage to the people who are directly impacted by these developments. You know, the people that are impacted by these are, you know, truly the experts. And they inevitably lead to gentrification, increased policing, and street sweeps that serve as like a dead end for houseless people. And we'll talk about that.
It's a new approach to easing the Bay Area housing crunch. KPX5's Don Lin on the push to make it easier for developers to build and why some protesters are pushing back.
You've heard of NIMBY, not in my backyard. Now a new movement is catching on. YIMBY, yes, in my backyard. YIMBYs are holding a three-day conference in Oakland on how to build more housing.
Years and decades of underbuilding.
The keynote speaker today was State Senator Scott Wiener.
All the stuff you're hearing on the news, it's a lie. What is YIMBY really? I mean, it's been going on for a while. In San Francisco, it's sort of like built up to it. These really intense developer campaigns to sort of win over public opinion, like these sort of strategies of trying to make people who are coming out to protest and can clearly see that they're going to be gentrified and pushed and displaced to sort of just allow it to happen. And So what is YIMBY and why is it a problem? Because YIMBY has basically destroyed the consensus among the left or organizers or whatever you want to call it, that building new development in a underserved neighborhood is bad. Like in general, I feel activists have always kind of just sort of intrinsically understood that.
Right. Like since at least the 1960s, when James Baldwin was talking to people in San Francisco for Take This Hammer.
Now, with all of these beautiful buildings, now they're going to be ringed in by hostile people, just like
we
have in New York.
Hostile and frightened people. Because they don't, they walk down the street and wonder why the first Negro boy they see looks at them as though he wants to kill them, and if he gets a chance, tries. But there's a time in my life and I would have felt just like blowing it up. That building, it has absolutely no foundation, and it really does not have any foundation. It's going to come down one way or another. Either we will correct what's wrong or it'll be corrected for us.
It was really funny. We had one black supervisor in the city whose name is Terry Francois, who was really terribly upset with us because we were taking on the city government, you know, to try and block the process of the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency.
What YIMBY has done since it's come along is completely undermined that sort of collective, sort of shared understanding about how gentrification works, how gentrification is extinction of colonization, how it's real estate and like it's stolen land and all this stuff. It sort of flipped the script completely in these terrifying ways where people will think that there's a housing shortage, which we'll talk more and explain why that is one of the central YIMBY lies. They will believe that, you know, supply side, all these people who are living in tents, you know, like it's the 1920s, you know, they need to, you know, we need to have this kind of housing program. So like YIMBY sort of plays to like a lot of these sentiments, but it's nothing like those programs that build public housing. It isn't public housing, which we're going to explain more in detail. Of course, the Mission, because it's such prime real estate, has been the site of many different really intense fights over the years. There was the Beast on Bryant fight that took the place where Cell Space once was, and there was the whole Monster in the Mission fight, which people were able to actually stop from happening, which was sort of a victory. And there's also the Vita fight, where, if people don't know, Vita is a luxury condo building on Mission.
Corner of 22nd and Mission, where construction cranes tower above the street. They're in the process of building a brand new high-rise condo building called Vita.
People had been trying to organize against it for 15 years. Vita is on Mission in 21st, sort of like really prime real estate. And you had Gavin Newsom raving about how it was his miracle mile and how much he wanted to, you know, sort of, you know, see the birth of the new Mission happening there. There was like, you know, incredible strong opposition against all these different developers. Some of the projects went through, like Beast of Bryant was finally built. And it got built due to payouts to various community groups to not protest. People did protest at the Kelly Moore paint store down on Mission and Cesar Chavez.
And what this developer is proposing to build behind us is more condominiums, 60 more condominiums for our neighborhood. Yeah!
People protested all kinds of things, like, for example, the Beast on Bryant was actually a fight that was still going on when Vita was being built. Why is it there? How did it happen? And like, why aren't people protesting it? Well, it's because the developers figured out that they needed to give buyouts to basically a lot of the anti-displacement nonprofits in the Mission and all the opposition that was trying to stop it.
It's currently in construction. It's about 5 stories high right now.
The developer was really successful at working with community groups.
In order to get support for this development, the developer gave substantial donations to a lot of community groups.
Gave is maybe a strong word here, right? I mean, isn't there a little bit of strategic cajoling?
Everyone got what they wanted.
Well, we'll see about that.
Look at how dangerous this fire was for crews. You can see firefighters scaling ladders and fire escapes just as burning debris falls from the top of the building. Just treacherous.
Yeah, the fire has displaced dozens of people, leaving them with no place to stay tonight.
40 people who have been displaced.
Not paranoid people, but reasonable people believe that arson is responsible.
Also, people remember Hawk and Keddie Lou were the landlords of an apartment building. There was like a horrible catastrophic fire.
I just heard 40 people displaced, and it's next to the Vita.
Since 2015, we've had 6 fires in the Mission.
What happened is that real estate interests changed tactics and created YIMBY. And so what YIMBY is it's like a luxury condo activist, except they aren't activists. They're astroturfed, and astroturfing is of course like when you pay to create the semblance of a grassroots movement to show up at public comment and other sort of commissions that are trying to make decisions, like sort of environmental review boards around whether or not things can be built in certain places, you know, whether or not a massive high rise is going to cast a shadow on a neighborhood, just all sorts of different things. And then you have these people who show up out of the blue. Often recently, as we will explain, recently moved into your town to be an advocate of building this thing.
Hi, supervisors. My name is Mark Randenberger, and I'm a resident of Telegraph Hill in District 3. And I'm a renter. I'm not a native San Franciscan. And apparently in that city, that makes me a second-class citizen. Because the city has done nothing while we are in an urgent housing crisis. People can barely afford to live here. Local control has failed. It's time to give the state a chance. Oppose this resolution. Support SB 827.
YIMBYs are upheld by technocrats and their ideology. I mean, the biggest funders in California of YIMBYs are guys from Microsoft, Yelp, Google.
Google's CEO explains the company's $1 billion investment for residential housing. Apple is giving $2.5 billion to the cause. And in Seattle, Microsoft is chipping in $500 million. and neighbors Amazon have opened a homeless shelter in their downtown campus.
Their whole philosophy is based on a very, you know, there's so many different people who have disproved the Reaganomics trickle-down theory that is behind. It's like a very libertarian theory that eventually, if you build new housing, it will be affordable to the rest of us.
My name is Evan Kirkpatrick. I'm the founder and CEO of Wendell Charles Financial and a contributor to Forbes. And the truth about trickle-down economics is it doesn't work.
It's just not the case. We've seen, especially as the real estate industry becomes more and more controlled by gigantic conglomerates, they can afford to have a place sit empty for years and years and years, so they don't set a precedent that the area becomes cheaper. Yeah, and as Mary Crisis mentioned, the media has taken this up as well. YIMBYs call themselves the pro-housing arm of the tenants movement. Of course, most of them own houses and condos. The media will use them as the only voice on the quote-unquote pro-tenant, pro-like affordable housing side of an argument. Their trickle-down kind of supply and demand Chicago school economics that is extremely libertarian in nature relies on this idea it's okay for us to continue to allow real estate speculate on land and allow the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in the Bay Area who are unhoused or precariously housed, about to be unhoused because the eviction moratoriums are ending post-COVID. So it's a pretty insidious, you know, fake grassroots astroturfing narrative.
I feel like it makes sense to bring in Zillow as well, just like to emphasize that cognitive disconnect where like these like real estate capitalists are showing people that there's so many homes that are available or empty. And they just like can't put two and two together to put people in homes.
Yeah. And there are lots of stats to back up. Their narrative is totally bunk, even from people who are ostensibly on their side, like this website, Zillow, which is a real estate website, estimated that there are 100,000 empty homes pre-COVID-19 pandemic. And now, 2 years into the pandemic, it's probably doubled that. And that's that could house the houseless in San Francisco easily several times over. And YIMBYs are always talking about this concept of a quote-unquote healthy vacancy rate.
Oh, Mary, no. Look, there's no such thing as a healthy vacancy rate. Like, gay shame wants everyone to have a house. And just this idea that in order for the economy to function like the well-oiled machine that we know capitalism never is, unless it's slaughtering indigenous people and enslaving people, doesn't work like that, doesn't care about that, doesn't need that at all. We could just give all the housing we want to everyone, whoever needs it. Like,
tied any of this into like the whole like technocratic approach, the professionalization, and the way that it like mixes in with like the type of people who are moving into these neighborhoods, and the idea that, you know, these poor people don't know how to, you know, take care of this for themselves. So we have like this idea backed by science or something like that, or backed by market economics. Mm-hmm. So it like ties in all of these libertarian ideas, as well as like the character of people moving into these neighborhoods with the policies that they're...
Community could have been restored with a minimum of buildings torn down. But when we get into the question of the present system of capitalism, it was not in the capitalist interest to do it. They have the expertise, they have the technology, they got the money, but they don't have the interest.
Yeah. Sorry. I think like a good thing to add, I can't think of the term Mary Napkins, but like, I know what you're talking about. I think that, like, in relation to this, like, it's really important to make the distinction that YIMBYs and the people that, like, are for these developments have no proximity to houselessness, have probably never experienced it. A lot of people, when I first moved out here and, like, met people at my job, they weren't fucking paying their rents. Their parents were. That's like the case for, I mean, like, not for, like, everybody that lives in these places, but, like, a lot of them, you know?
And if any of this is confusing, you are not alone, because the whole point of a lot of their arguments is to make them sound like mental labyrinths. They want you to feel confused. They want you to, as someone who is not looking at policy every day, is not headed to City Hall or paying attention to what's happening block by block in your city. They are trying to confuse you. And if you mention that, you are going to be shut down as somebody who just doesn't know what they're talking about. And that tends to be people of color, people who are lower income.
It's all the neoliberal things. It's basically like all the neoliberal shit. Like, I can't
see. Yeah, I mean, Sonia in the libertarian newspaper for the Libertarian Party of SF wrote that thing that she was like, I don't want subsidized, supervised, affordable housing. I want to consume housing the way I consume all other products.
I think it's really good to sort of just understand that YIMBYism is just pure neoliberal. It's something that sounds appealing. It's actually a hustle. It's always trying to hustle you in some way. And that YIMBYs are always trying to make something that sounds, oh, this doesn't sound that bad. But it's always like, you know, it's always about trying to elevate the sort of speculative value of real estate. That's always what they want at the end of the day. So, like, for example, something that they'll always will try to do in order to confuse anti-displacement activists is sort of promise that there'll be affordable units that they'll make off-site from a certain place. And then it'll make it sound like a good idea. And then people will be like, well, that sounds like it's worthwhile and blah, blah, blah. And that it's going to, you know, offset the losses that they'll get. And it never does. Like, the YIMBYs will always get a lot more out of any kind of thing that it is, if they ever build it in the first place, because that's also true, because it's always often an empty promise. Like, there's no guarantee that they build these things, and they'll always be like, oh, we're trying to give you these things, but they never materialize.
Gave is maybe a strong word here, right? I mean, isn't there a little bit of strategic cajoling to get this project through in a notoriously vocal activist community?
So I've been told time and time again from people all over the city that the Mission is the most vociferous group of dissent you will ever run against in San Francisco, that they're incredibly well organized. They have tons of nonprofits that band together. I think one attorney put it to me, you're going to run into a buzzsaw.
So Lauren, in the case of the Vita developer, what did the wielding of the buzzsaw get for the community?
He agreed to a land dedication over on Shotwell Street of a auto body shop that's going to get demolished, and they're going to build all affordable housing there. The community will get about 40 units of affordable housing instead of the about 13 they would have got if it had been built on site. That was another thing the community really fought for in the negotiations over this building.
So sort of a win for the community, but the developer still gets to build a bunch of market rate condos.
Everyone got what they wanted.
Or they'll like we were talking about with the yuppie fish bowl.
Yuppie fish tank.
Yuppie fish tank theory. Or the idea that all the rich people, the yuppies, will move into these towers instead of gentrifying other areas.
Gentrification looks like in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. So here's a big empty lot. It's about to be developed. So you'd think in this new lot in Williamsburg, the new building would be 30 to 40 stories tall, maybe taller, right? No, it's about 6 stories tall. And that's what's unfortunate. In Williamsburg, you have a lot of wealthy employees who...
And it's based on some pretty compelling evidence. In this paper, researchers studied 11 different major cities in America. And they found that building big luxury towers like that relieves pressure on the rest of the housing market. Specifically in LA, building a bunch...
The land has been reclaimed. For money, and that the people who are putting up the houses expect to make a profit. But it seems to me, I'm not attacking what's called a profit motive. There are some things more important than profits. I know that New York City has been turned into a desert, really, for the same reason. And it's happening in San Francisco now, It's as though the society made the assumption, and certainly acts on the assumption, that to make money is more important than to have citizens. You're paying too high a price for this. Because this is only what it's doing to Negro children, which is, God knows, bad enough. It's what it does to white children.
You know what I call big old buildings like that? Anti-gentrification towers.
And adolescents know it.
Well, it's kind of like the idea that if we build this thing in here, then people aren't going to move into single family homes and people aren't going to displace people. But it's always like a lightning rod that sort of draws in more development. That's like always what happens.
Yeah, Mary interrupted. I thought you had a really good way of putting just kind of the veil that they have created, the YIMBYs have created.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. And I think what you were saying before really gets to the heart of it, where, you know, they're quite young, the people who make up YIMBYs, kind of as a reaction to NIMBYs, basically, where, you know, I can't remember which Mary said this earlier, but where NIMBYs are raising their property values by preventing development, where, and then YIMBYs are raising property values by encouraging development, but they're able to kind of like use a lot of this like language of like civil rights and intersectionality and everything, and like pull from this liberal university education and appeal to younger generations alongside all of this like market knowledge, and to kind of like remarket themselves and like build this sort of PR presence where they seem like the most reasonable kind of way forward in this housing debate.
And the reason I'm here was an op-ed I wrote in response to an article written in the website Truthout. And it was written by a journalist and a student whose names I'm going to mispronounce, but they were writing about the YIMBY movement. And there was sort of a throwaway moment in their article, but what they described was a breakfast between Sonia Trauss.
This group calls itself YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard.
Welcome everybody to the Rally for Housing.
Sonia Trauss, hobbled by a broken foot, is hopping mad about the lack of new construction, which she says is inflating housing prices throughout the Bay Area.
It's caused by zoning, but it's also caused by super local control. That's really what it is.
And you're trying to disrupt that.
Yeah.
Who is the head of SF BARF, the San Francisco Bay Area Renters Federation, and Peter Thiel. And Peter Thiel, as you probably know, is a big Silicon Valley investor and founder, and not incidentally has been somewhat an advisor to Donald Trump. Sonia had the oatmeal, and Peter Thiel had the quiche. And from this, we have the genesis of a conspiracy. The implication, though, is that just because they sat down together and shared their quiche and oatmeal, that somehow it is evidence of this capitalist. And that's what I find really problematic about all this, regardless of how you feel about capitalism, colonialism, and gentrification and so forth, that the idea that communication and dialogue is a bad thing.
Yeah, and this colonization really isn't a metaphor. I mean, Shellmount is literally what's happening. Like the plan, the Scott Wiener's plan to help developers build on sacred ancestral, like, you know, territory or like really important religious sites that are held by local like Ohlone folks in the Bay Area is literally like them just trying to figure out how to like extend the horizon of Manifest Destiny after they've already discovered everything.
And I also think it's important to note why YIMBYism and why YIMBYs themselves are so violent. And here at Gay Shame, like, they are no different than a fascist.
Now we have new state laws, the conservatorship laws, that can reinstitute that pipeline and help the city compel people to accept treatment. London Breed has endorsed me, and she is a leader on these conservatorship laws. So it's really important to make sure that there's someone on the Board of Supervisors that's going to cooperate with London Breed and support her. Please show the city that you need your neighborhoods to not be plagued by drug use and drug dealing, and that you care about people enough to help them get the treatment that they need.
People think that there is a long line, like it's a distance between the people living in these units and like in support of them, whether or not they actually live there, but if they, you know, love seeing fucking condos, all the way down to the people who get the police called on them. And that's primarily like Black and brown people, people experiencing houselessness, trans people, and people experiencing like substance use and detox in conjunction with all of these things in some cases. You know, the people that live in these developments are very quick to call the cops. They call 311, they use Nextdoor, and they are responsible and complicit in the sweeps that happen. And these sweeps, what people fail to understand is that when these sweeps happen, people are not really met up with resources right away. If anything, they get their livelihood taken away from them, their belongings. In a lot of cases that I've read, their medication. We're going to talk about this a little bit more, but all of this could really be solved if all of these empty units were just made readily accessible and people didn't have to jump through all of these hoops, these bureaucratic hoops, just to obtain housing. And the problem with, you know, all of these techies like calling the cops all the time, you know, they're calling the cops on people who were, you know, born and raised in this neighborhood, who has seen all of these changes and everything happen to them in their life. It just ends up being, it's not even dystopian because it's real, but it's literally just like a tech fantasy land. It's a sea of white people, just rich white people.
And the irony of it is that, I mean, San Francisco's had drug culture forever. So like, what are they, you know, and how it's like, obviously classed and racialized in this messed up way. It's like, who is able to, you know, come to San Francisco and like live their best life, and who's going to be pathologized for it and criminalized for it and incarcerated for it in order to preserve their property values?
And this is, yeah, one of the examples when YIMBYs come out using the language of fascism, which it's pretty close to their ideology more generally. They would rather see an empty new condo than they would a low-income person housed. And that's why, I mean, gay shame is very much for stealing, quote unquote, all of the empty houses, all of the empty condos.
Say real quick, if we're talking about speculation a lot, and something that we've noticed and a lot of people have also observed is that it has kind of a feel to it. It has kind of a pro-life kind of feel to it, like for the people who haven't arrived, the people who will come. It's never for people who are here now on the street. It's never for people who, you know, are applying in a lottery, as we were mentioning earlier, as Mary Crisis was saying earlier, like you're in a lottery and you're trying to desperately get these like few available units. It's never for, they don't actually care about housing people. They're only interested in building stuff. And, you know, that could be for, often is for international investment opportunities. So the people can have their third and fourth, so like techies can have their third and fourth home.
So this below market rate model is supplanting all the public housing that has been a like saving grace for people over the years. People are working hard, including the YIMBYs, politicians, to get rid of public housing and replace it with this allegedly below market rate affordable housing. And affordable, again, I'm using that in the most kind of satirical way, because you have to have amazing credit to even apply for these limited number of units. It's 13% here in San Francisco for every new condo development. The formula to decide what those units are priced at is based on, well, it can go up to 150% of what people make in the area. I know that's a lot of math right there, but basically I think it was made confusing for a reason. You have a bunch of people competing for 13% of a new building's apartments in some kind of lotto. Think about like having to go to the bank, you have to get certified as through the city, through these weird nonprofits, jump through all these hoops in order to get on the list.
One thing that I hear a lot from YIMBYs or YIMBY aligned folks or people who are kind of like on the fence about YIMBYism as a whole is that they are trying to combat houselessness. And the only way to do that is to fix this quote unquote housing shortage and build more affordable housing. Most of these units in these condos or luxury condos, luxury apartment buildings are about like market rate. I don't know any person that is not a techie that can afford an apartment at market rate. And even in these developments, the property developers, if they do end up doing like a certain percentage of units at quote unquote, like below market rate, what ends up happening is that you have thousands of applicants who are like low income or experiencing houselessness. And sometimes in systems, people coming from like the shelter in place hotels or like Project Home Key or safe sleeping villages, you know, they have things like coordinated entry or a hotline they're supposed to call that kind of like gives them options that are not really options, right? Like a lot of people think that all of the rich people are just going to like move into these units and our neighborhoods are good to go. But no one really talks about how these same people are wealth hoarding. They're taking not only if they do end up living in these luxury condos, who's to say that they're not going to take your house or take your neighbor's house? Happens all the time.
Yeah. It's cover for the city to say, look, we're building affordable units when they are affordable only to people who don't live in the neighborhood.
So we have given you a lot of the history, a lot of the specific cases, and you're probably wondering, what is a YIMBY? What is a YIMBY? So YIMBYs, the idea that you should really come away from this podcast understanding is that they are pro-density, pro-development shills. They're kind of like puppets of an industry. They're kind of like advocates, not really like an advocate per se, but more like a hired henchman, who goes in certain kinds of policy areas specifically to transform public opinion and get people on the side of building as many luxury units as possible, because you have to understand, like, it's never about actually putting people in housing. It's actually about maximizing profit by trying to create a building, a structure that has as many investment opportunities for whoever as possible. It's never like they're never feasible. It never makes sense. They're never in places that make sense. They just want to get it built. And people have to understand that this is a violent extractive process. It's environmentally hazardous. It destroys communities and all like completely erases like the cultural profile of a given metropolitan area. But it also devastates the environment, like constant construction. We can't just constantly keep clear cutting forests. We can't constantly be, you know, extracting metals to build steel girders and all these different things, all these different resources to build housing that no one actually wants. Housing that often after it's constructed will get torn down within like 5 years. Ideally, in a YIMBY world, there's always some construction happening. It's things are being torn down to build new things constantly. One really interesting example of this is not a housing example is, you know, people who live in San Francisco are familiar that there is a mall for some reason, San Francisco has a San Francisco Center. And then on the block next to it, there's just a vacant mall that sat vacant for 6 years at this point. How long has it been vacant? And it's just constructed for no reason. Now, why is that allowed to happen? Well, because everyone cashed out. The developer built it. It's sitting there, you know, it doesn't serve any actual function. But at the same time, it's interesting that particular location was a squat and people were trying to like wage a war against land struggle by trying to create like a free and open space where people could, you know, make, you know, build community. And it's like the exact opposite of this vacant mall. This is sitting there for yuppies or sitting there for techies and whatever.
Yeah. And they use the terminology, the lingo, the affect of the housing movement, which makes it even more insidious. The headquarters here in San Francisco was at the same time holding a neoliberal YIMBY, a subgroup of the YIMBY action group meetings, as well as the socialist YIMBY group, another subgroup. Neither of them lasted very long. And it's why it made sense over the summer, the YIMBYs within a week held events with the Cato Institute, which is a Koch brothers, let's privatize the Postal Service, Social Security, and get rid of any kind of welfare system. So they had an event with the Cato Institute, but also had a racial justice teach-in because the protests were happening in the wake of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Tony McDade.
Yeah, so I just wanted to jump in. There's like an environmentalist sort of tack that a lot of YIMBYs like to use when they're talking about you know, the impact of this development, or at least like how much more responsible they're being with all of these new buildings that make the development look like it's like a positive addition to the neighborhood, or that it's like replacing buildings that, you know, like had asbestos or something like that. But I mean, on the one hand, construction's an extremely environmentally destructive industry, you know, concrete and everything like that. I think specifically also in like earthquake prone areas like San Francisco, there's only so far you can build with wood before it becomes dangerous in terms of earthquake ratings. And I think that's built into the code of San Francisco's kind of construction. But I think another one that I've kind of been interested in is that, you know, there's like LEED and ISO certifications for all of these buildings. And just in terms of like talking about like making infrastructural space look more attractive to people who like prioritize or see these as like pluses because they feel better moving into these buildings. They're more like rated environmental in some way, or, you know, like they follow these like international specifications. They're like kind of repackaging these buildings as something that is like a better kind of building almost that they're adding to the neighborhood while basically masking all of the other, you know, terrible things they're doing to people who are already living here. Yeah. And like one thing that's interesting that I learned a couple months ago reading, it's a book called Infrastructure Space, I believe. I can't remember who it's by. But like ISO ratings and all of these certifications are managed by private entities. So they're not public certifications. And so, you know, there's a group of business leaders who get together to determine what these certifications are. And it's quite common in third world countries, let's say, for instance, for these certifications to be used to gatekeep basically who gets what sort of international funding where. And it's a very similar situation on the ground here where like nonprofits or buildings or anything, like they get state funding or they get all of the support based on whether or not they're adhering to these basically privately determined certifications. But on the whole, it makes them look better to people who have like more progressive tendencies when they're looking at whether or not this building is like environmentally friendly, for instance.
They're trying to guarantee that only people that look like them and are from a certain background can exist in these worlds, and it's fascist.
It's fascist, yes.
Is one of you guys Finch? You're Finch?
Yeah.
So, hey, tell me what you're doing to offset your gentrification effects in San Francisco. How about this shit represents gentrification in my city that you ain't from? Where you from, partner?
I'm an immigrant here. I was born in Missouri. I immigrated here.
And you gentrify my city. What do you do to offset your effects on gentrification in my city?
I'm trying to empower artists to do more art in the city. I really am.
But this is empowering artists from San Francisco? Is this empowering artists from San Francisco?
Yeah.
How, nigga? Tell me how, blood.
Because people are gonna be able to put more mural.
You know what people are gonna put here? People are gonna put graffiti over this shit because it runs represents gentrification in my city.
Yeah, but then later on someone else is gonna come in and put another mural. And that's part of the American dream.
Coming from Missouri to California is not immigration.
I'm an immigrant to San Francisco.
No, you're a gentrifier to San Francisco.
What's the difference between a gentrifier and an immigrant then? Is everybody who's new bad? Like, we can have no new people?
You don't understand what gentrification means, bro.
I understand what gentrification means.
And you don't understand the displacement effects that it has?
I understand. Again, this sounds crazy, but it's like, I raised $100,000 to distribute directly to artists in San Francisco who are out of work.
Then why do all the artists in San Francisco fucking hate you, from San Francisco fucking hate you, bro?
I think there's a variety of reasons for that. I think one of them is jealousy, honestly.
Like, are you talking to the police right now?
I got this wall, and this is a very cool wall, and people are jealous.
Yeah, we're fucking jealous that fucking white people like you can come to our state and have a better life than the people that were born and raised here. Yeah, we're jealous of it. We're jealous that fucking you can have this wall, but the artisans from San Francisco can't. Yeah, we're jealous, bro. All right, I don't have all day for this.
Where, like, EMBs try to use this kind of rhetorical tool to be like, you know, you're either with us or against us, and they'll say, you know, like, if we don't like this sort of, like, open borders idea that they want, where, like, people who are living here don't want gentrifiers to move in, but it's like, we can tell who gentrifiers are. It's like, it's not a question of not being xenophobic in any sort of, like, an analogous way, but recognizing that people are coming in and destroying neighborhoods, and that there are, like, clear consequences to them moving in.
So when you hear Laura Foot Moss asking, where am I going to live? She literally means that shit. She wants to know where her personal white ass is going to be living. Like, she doesn't care about the people who are already living here, the kinds of communities that existed here. She doesn't care about anyone who is of a lower income bracket than her or doesn't have her high education and all that stuff and her wealthy CIA parents. Like, she just, yeah, she doesn't, it doesn't, that's all that she wants.
And yeah, there's certain words that they love to use that make it seem like they are really building the world that we all want to live in. And so they'll have names like East Bay for Everyone. They'll have, you know, growth in the name and ostensibly, you know, mean like growth for like jobs and like the more parks and, but it's really just growth for them. It's growth for their real estate and tech overlords. And it's all comes down to the money.
So now that we've told you a little bit of all the information that we've amassed about YIMBYs, you're probably wondering, oh no, do I know any YIMBYs? Have I been hanging in? Have I been breaking bread and enjoying a boba with a YIMBY? Well, these are five signs that your friend might be turning or transforming if they aren't already a YIMBY.
Does your friend fetishize glass high rises when you're walking through the city together, being like, ooh, that's a nice one?
Did Scott Wiener officiate their wedding?
Has your friend ever asked you out on a date to come to public comment in favor of a new condo?
Does your friend have a Finch honey bear in the window?
Does your friend ever say that? Does your friend ever come to you saying, we need more neighbors?
Does your friend only go to the Marina Safeway?
Is your friend a landlord? Does your friend identify as an immigrant, but they're white from the upper crust, has a landlord for a father? And does your white friend who moved all the way up from Stanford to San Francisco consider themselves an immigrant? Do they love a disposable scooter hogging up the sidewalk?
Well, I hope this helped clarify what YIMBYs are, where they come from, you know, how to identify them. And just wanted to underline that we're behind 100% low and no income housing. Has them all now. And fuck Nancy and Ronald Reagan.
So, yes, that was Gay Shame telling you about YIMBYs. We've done the best we could to help you navigate this incredibly tricky rhetorical terrain. Remember that YIMBYs will try to trip you up, will try to confuse you, make you have you going in circles at public comment and tripping and trying to, you know, out debate bro you, just remember that they are not your friend, that they only care about, the only thing that they care about is the bottom line, and they're always going to be doing the will of the real estate industry. So once again, this is Gay Shame signing off. How to fight the Yimbies. I have been Mary Napkins.
I've been Mary, not creative, and better on paper.
I'm Mary Crisis.
This is Mary Interrupted. Thanks for your time.
Yeah.
We'll be watching. Total War. We'll see you on Next Door.
We did something. We gave time.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Should it be a big deal that a Black, queer, femme, body-positive woman is on the cover of a yoga journal magazine? No. But is it? Yes, because we are literally in the desert trying to find any oasis of more people of color and representation.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. A few weeks ago on our show, we spoke with Asami Martins, who is the founder of Our Colorful Yoga, a BIPOC wellness community and initiative in Montreal. To continue these conversations, we reached out to a podcast called Yoga is Dead. Yoga is Dead is a podcast that explores power, privilege, fair pay, harassment, race, cultural appropriation, and capitalism in the wellness industry. So here's our interview with the women behind Yoga is Dead.
So can you tell us about yourselves and how you met and what made you decide to do